Listening to ICANN on HD2.
KQAC HD2 Portland 89.9.
KQOC HD2 Glen Eden Beach 88.1.
KSLC HD2 McMinnville 90.3.
KQHR HD2, The Dalles and Hood River 88.1.
The complete works of Winnie the Pooh. The immortal stories from the books Winnie the Pooh and The House at Pooh Corner. And poems from When We Were Very Young and Now We Are Six by Alan Alexander Milne. Presented for radio, unabridged, in 18 parts. Produced by Christopher Toyne and performed by Peter Dennis. Part 17, in which Eeyore finds the Wallery and Owl moves into it.
In which Eeyore finds the Wallery and Owl moves into it. Pooh had wandered into the 100-acre wood and was standing in front of what had once been Owl's house. It didn't look at all like a house now. It looked like a tree which had been blown down. And as soon as a house looks like that, it is time you tried to find another one. Pooh had had a mysterious message underneath his front door that morning saying,
"I am searching for a new house for Owl, so had you, Rabbit."
And while he was wondering what it meant, Rabbit had come in and read it for him.
"I'm leaving one for all the others," said Rabbit, "and telling them what it means, and they'll all search too. I'm in a hurry. Goodbye."
And he had run off. Pooh followed slowly. He had something better to do than to find a new house for Owl. He had to make up a Pooh song about the old one, because he had promised Piglet days and days ago that he would. And whenever he and Piglet had met since, Piglet didn't actually say anything, but you knew at once why he didn't. And if anybody mentioned hums, or trees, or string, or storms in the night, Piglet's nose went all pink at the tip, and he talked about something quite different in a hurried sort of way.
"But it isn't easy,"
said Pooh to himself as he looked at what had once been Owl's house,
"because poetry and hums aren't things which you get. They're things which get you, and all you can do is to go where they can find you."
He waited hopefully.
"Well," said Pooh after a long wait, "I shall begin 'Here Lies a Tree,' because it does. And then I'll see what happens."
This is what happened.
"Here lies a tree which Owl, a bird, was fond of when it stood on end. And Owl was talking to a friend, called me, in case you hadn't heard, when something ooh occurred. For lo, the wind was blusterous and flattened out his favourite tree, and things looked bad for him and we. Look bad, I mean, for he and us. I've never known them was. Then Piglet, thought a thing. Courage, he said. There's always hope. I want a thinnish piece of rope. Or if there isn't any, bring a thickish piece of string. So to the letterbox he rose, while Pooh and Owl said, oh, and hum. And where the letters always come, call letters only Piglet squoze, his head and then his toes. Oh, gallant Piglet, Piglet ho! Did Piglet tremble, did he blinch? No, no, he struggled inch by inch through letters only, as I know, because I saw him go. He ran, and then he stood and shouted, help for Owl, a bird, and Pooh, a bear, until he heard the others coming through the wood as quickly as they could. Help, help, and rescue, Piglet cried, and showed the others where to go. Sing ho, for Piglet, Piglet ho. And soon the door was opened wide, and we were both outside. Sing ho, for Piglet ho, ho. So there it is, said Pooh when he had sung this to himself three times. It's come different from what I thought it would, but it's come. Now I must go and sing it to Piglet.
I am searching for a new house for Owl, so had you, Rabbit.
What's all this?
Said Eeyore. Rabbit explained.
What's the matter with his old house?
Rabbit explained.
Nobody tells me, said Eeyore. Nobody keeps me informed. I make it 17 days come Friday since anybody spoke to me.
It certainly isn't 17 days.
Come Friday, explained Eeyore.
And today's Saturday, said Rabbit, so that would make it 11 days, and I was here myself a week ago.
Not conversing, said Eeyore, not first one and then the other. You said hello and flashed past. I saw your tail 100 yards up the hill as I was meditating my reply. I had thought of saying, what? But of course it was then too late.
Well, I was in a hurry.
No give and take,
Eeyore went on.
No exchange of thought. Hello? What? I mean, it gets you nowhere. Particularly if the other person's tail is only just in sight for the second half of the conversation.
It's your fault, Eeyore. You've never been to see any of us. You just stay here in this one corner of the forest, waiting for the others to come to you. Why don't you go to them sometimes? Eeyore was silent for a little while, thinking.
There may be something in what you say, Rabbit,
he said at last.
I have been neglecting you. I must move about more. I must come and go.
That's right, Eeyore. Drop in on any of us at any time when you feel like it.
Thank you, Rabbit. And if anybody says in a loud voice, bother, it's Eeyore, I can drop out again.
Rabbit stood on one leg for a moment. Well, he said, I must be going. I'm rather busy this morning.
Goodbye,
said Eeyore. What? Oh, goodbye. And if you happen to come across a good house for Owl, you must let us know.
I will give my mind to it, said Eeyore.
Rabbit went. Pooh had found Piglet, and they were walking back to the 100-acre wood together.
Piglet,
said Pooh a little shyly after they had walked for some time without saying anything.
Yes, Pooh?
Do you remember when I said that a respectful Pooh song might be written about you-know-what?
Did you, Pooh?
Said Piglet, getting a little pink round the nose.
Oh, yes. I believe you did.
It's been written, Piglet. The pink went slowly up Piglet's nose to his ears and settled there.
Has it, Pooh?
He asked huskily. About that time when... Do you mean really written?
Yes, Piglet. The tips of Piglet's ears glowed suddenly, and he tried to say something. But even after he had husked once or twice, nothing came out. So Pooh went on.
There are 7 verses in it.
7?
Said Piglet as carelessly as he could.
You don't often get 7 verses in a hum, do you, Pooh?
Never, said Pooh. I don't suppose it's ever been heard of before.
Do the others know yet?
Asked Piglet, stopping for a moment to pick up a stick and throw it away.
No, said Pooh. And I wondered which you would like best, for me to hum it now, or to wait till we find the others, and then hum it to all of you.
Piglet thought for a little.
I think what I'd like best, Pooh, is... I'd like you to hum it to me now, and then to hum it to all of us, because then everybody would hear it. But I could say, oh, yes, Pooh's told me, and pretend not to be listening.
So Pooh hummed it to him, all the 7 verses, and Piglet said nothing, but just stood and glowed. For never before had anyone sung Ho for Piglet, Piglet Ho, by himself. When it was over, he wanted to ask for one of the verses over again, but didn't quite like to. It was the verse beginning, O gallant Piglet, and it seemed to him a very thoughtful way of beginning a piece of poetry.
Did I really do all that?
He said at last.
Well, said Pooh, in poetry, in a piece of poetry, well, you did it, Piglet, because the poetry says you did. And that's how people know.
Oh,
said Piglet.
Because I thought I did blinch a little, just at first. And it says, did he blinch? No, no. That's why.
You only blinched inside, said Pooh. And that's the bravest way for a very small animal not to blinch that there is.
Piglet sighed with happiness and began to think about himself. He was brave. When they got to Owl's old house, they found everybody else there except Eeyore. Christopher Robin was telling them what to do, and Rabbit was telling them again directly afterwards in case they hadn't heard, and then they were all doing it. They had got a rope and were pulling Owl's chairs and pictures and things out of his old house so as to be ready to put them into his new one. Kanga was down below tying the things on and calling out to Owl,
You won't want this dirty old dishcloth any more, will you? And what about this carpet? It's all in holes.
And Owl was calling back indignantly,
Of course I do. It's just a question of arranging the furniture properly. And it isn't a dishcloth. It's my shawl.
Every now and then Roo fell in and came back on the rope with the next article, which flustered Kanga a little because she never knew where to look for him. So she got cross with Owl and said that his house was a disgrace, all damp and dirty, and it was quite time it did tumble down. Look at that horrid bunch of toadstools growing out of the corner there. So Owl looked down, a little surprised because he didn't know about this, and then gave a short, sarcastic laugh and explained that that was his sponge, and that if people didn't know a perfectly ordinary bath sponge when they saw it, things were coming to a pretty pass. Well, said Kanga, and Roo fell in quickly, crying,
I must see Owl's sponge. Oh, there it is. Oh, Owl. Owl, it isn't a sponge. It's a spudge. Do you know what a spudge is, Owl? It's when your sponge gets all...
And Kanga said, Roo, dear, very quickly, because that's not the way to talk to anybody who can spell Tuesday. But they were all quite happy when Pooh and Piglet came along, and they stopped working in order to have a little rest and listen to Pooh's new song. So then they all told Pooh how good it was, and Piglet said carelessly,
It is good, isn't it? I mean, as a song.
And what about the new house?
Asked Pooh.
Have you found it, Owl?
He's found a name for it, said Christopher Robin, lazily nibbling at a piece of grass. So now all he wants is the house.
I am calling it this,
said Owl importantly, and he showed them what he had been making. It was a square piece of board with the name of the house painted on it. The Wallery. It was at this exciting moment that something came through the trees and bumped into Owl. The board fell to the ground, and Piglet and Roo bent over it eagerly.
Oh, it's you,
said Owl crossly.
Hello, Eeyore, said Rabbit. There you are. Where have you been?
Eeyore took no notice of them.
Good morning, Christopher Robin,
he said, brushing away Roo and Piglet and sitting down on the Wallery.
Are we alone?
Yes, said Christopher Robin, smiling to himself.
I have been told the news has worked through to my corner of the forest, the damp bit down on the right, which nobody wants, that a certain person is looking for a house. I have found one for him.
Ah, well done, said Rabbit kindly.
Eeyore looked round slowly at him and then turned back to Christopher Robin.
We have been joined by something, he said in a loud whisper. But no matter. We can leave it behind. If you will come with me, Christopher Robin, I will show you the house.
Christopher Robin jumped up.
Come on, Pooh, he said.
Come on, Digger,
cried Roo.
Shall we go, Owl?
Said Rabbit.
Wait a moment,
said Owl, picking up his notice board, which had just come into sight again. Eeyore waved them back.
Christopher Robin and I are going for a short walk, he said. Not a jostle. If he likes to bring Pooh and Piglet with him, I shall be glad of their company. But one must be able to breathe.
That's all right, said Rabbit, rather glad to be left in charge of something. We'll go on getting the things out. Now then, Tigger, where's that rope? What's the matter, Owl?
Owl, who had just discovered that his new address was The Smear, coughed at Eeyore sternly, but said nothing, and Eeyore, with most of the Wallery behind him, marched off with his friends. So in a little while, they came to the house which Eeyore had found, and just before they came to it, Piglet was nudging Pooh, and Pooh was nudging Piglet, and they were saying,
It is.
And it can't be.
And it is really.
To each other. And when they got there, it really was.
There,
said Eeyore proudly, stopping them outside Piglet's house.
And the name on it, and everything.
Oh, cried Christopher Robin, wondering whether to laugh or what.
Just the house for Owl. Don't you think so, little Piglet?
And then Piglet did a noble thing. And he did it in a sort of dream, while he was thinking of all the wonderful words Pooh had hummed about him.
Yes, it's just the house for Owl,
he said grandly.
And I hope he'll be very happy in it.
And then he gulped twice. Because he had been very happy in it himself.
What do you think, Christopher Robin?
Asked Eeyore a little anxiously, feeling that something wasn't quite right. Christopher Robin had a question to ask first, and he was wondering how to ask it. Well, he said at last, it's a very nice house, and if your own house is blown down, you must go somewhere else, mustn't you, Piglet? What would you do if your house was blown down? Before Piglet could think, Pooh answered for him.
He'd come and live with me, said Pooh. Wouldn't you, Piglet?
Piglet squeezed his paw.
Thank you, Pooh,
he said.
I should love to.
Furry bear. If I were a bear, and a big bear too, I shouldn't much care if it froze or snew. I shouldn't much mind if it snowed or friz. I'd be all fur-lined with a coat like his. For I'd have fur boots and a brown fur wrap, and brown fur knickers and a big fur cap. I'd have a fur muffle ruff to cover my jaws, and brown fur mittens on my big brown paws. With a big brown furry down up to my head, I'd sleep all the winter in a big fur bed. Puppy and I met a man as I went walking. We got talking, man and I. "Where are you going to, man?" I said to the man as he went by. "Down to the village to get some bread. Will you come with me?" "No, not I." I met a horse as I went walking. We got talking, horse and I. "Where are you going to, horse, today?" I said to the horse as he went by. "Down to the village to get some hay. Will you come with me?" "No, not I." I met a woman as I went walking. We got talking, woman and I. "Where are you going to, woman, so early?" I said to the woman as she went by. "Down to the village to get some barley. Will you come with me?" "No, not I." I met some rabbits as I went walking. We got talking, rabbits and I. "Where are you going in your brown fur coats?" I said to the rabbits as they went by. "Down to the village to get some oats. Will you come with us?" "No, not I." I met a puppy as I went walking. We got talking, puppy and I. "Where are you going this nice fine day?" I said to the puppy as he went by. "Up in the hills to roll and play." "I'll come with you, puppy," said I. The Four Friends. Ernest was an elephant, a great big fellow. Leonard was a lion with a 6-foot tail. George was a goat, and his beard was yellow. And James was a very small snail. Leonard had a stall, and a great big strong one. Ernest had a manger, and its walls were thick. George found a pen, but I think it was the wrong one. And James sat down on a brick. Ernest started trumpeting and cracked his manger. Leonard started roaring and shivered his stall. James gave the huffle of a snail in danger, and nobody heard him at all. Ernest started trumpeting and raised such a rumpus. Leonard started roaring and trying to kick. James went a journey with the goat's new compass, and he reached the end of his brick. Ernest was an elephant and very well intentioned. Leonard was a lion with a brave new tail. George was a goat, as I think I have mentioned. But James was only a snail.
Pickwick lying in bed, sleeping peacefully.
Roo was washing his face and paws in the stream, while Kanga explained to everybody proudly that this was the first time he had ever washed his face himself. And Owl was telling Kanga an interesting anecdote full of long words like encyclopedia and rhododendron, to which Kanga wasn't listening.
"I don't hold with all this washing," grumbled Eeyore. "This modern behind-the-ears nonsense. What do you think, Pooh?"
"Well," said Pooh, "I think..."
But we shall never know what Pooh thought. For there came a sudden squeak from Roo, a splash, and a loud cry of alarm from Kanga.
"So much for washing," said Eeyore.
"Roo's fallen in," cried Rabbit, and he and Christopher Robin came rushing down to the rescue. "Look at me swimming!"
squeaked Roo from the middle of his pool, and was hurried down a waterfall into the next pool.
"Are you all right, Roo dear?"
called Kanga anxiously.
"Yes," said Roo. "Look at me swim."
And down he went over the next waterfall into another pool. Everybody was doing something to help. Piglet, wide awake suddenly, was jumping up and down and making,
oh, I say,
noises. Owl was explaining that in a case of sudden and temporary immersion, the important thing was to keep the head above water. Kanga was jumping along the bank saying, are you sure you're all right, Roo dear? To which Roo, from whatever pool he was in at the moment, was answering,
look at me swimming!
Eeyore had turned round and hung his tail over the first pool into which Roo fell, and with his back to the accident was grumbling quietly to himself and saying,
all this washing, but catch on to my tail, little Roo, and you'll be all right.
And Christopher Robin and Rabbit came hurrying past Eeyore and were calling out to the others in front of them.
All right, Roo, I'm coming,
called Christopher Robin.
Get something across the stream lower down, some of you fellows,
called Rabbit.
But Pooh was getting something. Two pools below Roo, he was standing with a long pole in his paws, and Kanga came up and took one end of it, and between them they held it across the lower part of the pool, and Roo, still bubbling proudly,
look at me swimming,
drifted up against it and climbed down.
Did you see me swimming?
Squeaked Roo excitedly, while Kanga scolded him and rubbed him down.
Pooh, Pooh, did you see me swimming? That's called swimming, what I was doing. Rabbit, did you see what I was doing? Swimming. Oh, hello, Piglet. I say, Piglet, what do you think I was doing? Swimming. Christopher Robin, did you?
But Christopher Robin wasn't listening. He was looking at Pooh. Pooh, he said, where did you find that pole? Pooh looked at the pole in his hand.
I just found it, he said. I thought it ought to be useful. I just picked it up.
Pooh, said Christopher Robin solemnly, the expedition is over. You have found the North Pole.
The King's Breakfast. The King asked the Queen, and the Queen asked the dairymaid,
could we have some butter for the royal slice of bread?
The Queen asked the dairymaid. The dairymaid said, certainly, I'll go and tell the cow now before she goes to bed. The dairymaid, she curtsied, and went and told the Alderney, don't forget the butter for the royal slice of bread. The Alderney said sleepily,
you'd better tell His Majesty that many people nowadays like marmalade instead.
The dairymaid said, fancy, and went to Her Majesty. She curtsied to the Queen, and she turned a little red. Excuse me, Your Majesty, for taking the liberty, but marmalade is tasty if it's very thickly spread. The Queen said, ooh, and went to His Majesty.
Talking of the butter for the royal slice of bread, many people think that marmalade is nicer. Would you like to try a little marmalade instead?
The King said, bother, and then he said, oh, deary me. The King sobbed, oh, deary me, and went back to bed. Nobody, he whimpered, could call me a fussy man. I only want a little bit of butter for my bread.
The Queen said, there, there, and went to the dairymaid. The dairymaid said, there, there, and went to the shed. The cow said, there, there, I didn't really mean it. Here's milk for his porringer and butter for his bread. The Queen took the butter and brought it to His Majesty. The King said, butter, eh? And bounced out of bed.
Nobody,
he said, as he kissed her tenderly.
Nobody, he said, as he slid down the banisters. Nobody, my darling, could call me a fussy man, but I do like a little bit of butter to my bread.
A thought. If I were John and John were me, then he'd be six and I'd be three. If John were me and I were John, I shouldn't have these trousers on.
The Complete Works of Winnie the Pooh, performed by Peter Dennis, based on the stage show Bother. Music composed and conducted by Don Davis. Piano played by Gloria Chang and clarinet by Charles Boito. Production recorded and mixed by Jeff Sykes at KCRW Santa Monica. Executive producer Jacqueline Delorier. Radio production directed by Christopher Toyne. A co-production of KCRW and Bother LA Production. You've just heard the complete works of Winnie the Pooh on ICAN HD2 and ICANradio.org. Unabridged recordings of the four Winnie the Pooh books can be found at downpour.com or by calling 1-855-369-6768.
You're listening to ICAN. Join us every day at this time for the complete works of Winnie the Pooh. That was in which Eeyore finds the woolery and Owl moves into it. Tune in tomorrow at the same time for the last program in the series, in which Christopher Robin and Pooh come to an enchanted place and we leave them there. Organ Repertory Singers Youth Choir is a place to discover and develop your love of singing. You can participate in community building retreats, work with the biggest composers in choral music, and perform in exciting concerts, festivals, and tours. You can sing all school year with their community of kindergarten through 12th grade singers. You can learn about financial aid, how to enroll, and other details online at orsingers.org.
The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2, with but one inning left to play.
Now batting, number 10, the left fielder, Cooney.
And so, when Cooney died at first...
Now batting, number 12, the first baseman, Barrows.
And Barrows did the same. A sickly silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought, if only Casey could but get a whack at that, we'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake, and the former was a pudding, and the latter was a fake. So upon that stricken multitude, grim melancholy sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let fly a single to the wonderment of all. And Blake, the much despised, tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and they saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe on second and Flynn a hugging third.
Casey.
Then from the gladdened multitude went up a joyous yell. It bounded from the mountaintop and rattled in the dell. It struck upon the hillside and recoiled upon the flat. For Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when, responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat, no stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then, while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip. And now, the leather-covered sphere came hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. That ain't my style, said Casey.
Strike one!
The umpire said. From the benches black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on a stern and distant shore.
Kill him! Kill the umpire!
Shouted someone from the stand. And it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew. But Casey still ignored it. And the umpire said,
strike two!
Fraud! Cried the maddened thousands, and the echo answered, fraud! But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain. And they knew that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lip. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball. And now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out.
The author of Casey at the Bat was not a famous poet like Robert Frost or Walt Whitman. The author of Casey at the Bat was a young newspaper columnist by the name of Ernest Lawrence Thayer. Now, you can probably guess that Ernest Lawrence Thayer was an American, but can you guess how old the poem itself is? Can you tell whether it was written yesterday or last year or when your dad and mom were young? Or even when your grandparents were young? Actually, the poem is even older than that. Casey at the Bat was written in 1888, well over 100 years ago. But how did Casey at the Bat become one of America's best-known poems if the author wasn't a poet and wasn't even famous? Well, that is a long story. Would you like to hear about it? Good. I thought so. Casey at the Bat was written by Ernest Lawrence Thayer, the son of a well-to-do businessman from Boston who owned textile mills where cloth was no longer woven by hand, but was manufactured by machines. It was the industrial age of the 1860s, and money was to be made in New England. Ernest was a serious student. He did all his homework, got very good grades, and was admitted to Harvard College. He was not always serious, however. Thayer had a wonderful sense of humor and was made editor of the Harvard Lampoon, the college humor magazine that still exists on the Harvard campus today. While there, he met many interesting people, among them William Randolph Hearst, who one day would become a great newspaper owner and publisher. Hearst did not remain at Harvard to graduate. Instead, the young Hearst was given the great responsibility of running the San Francisco Examiner, a newspaper then owned by his father. Thayer stayed on at Harvard to graduate and then traveled to Europe. He settled in Paris to brush up on his French. Then, in 1886, Hearst sent a cable to his college pal in Paris. Would Thayer come to San Francisco and write a humor column for the Examiner's Sunday supplement? Much to the disappointment of his father, who wanted Thayer to help him with the family woolen mills, Ernest accepted Hearst's offer and began writing for the paper later that year. After a year and a half, ill health overcame Thayer, and he moved back east to Massachusetts, but he continued writing for the Examiner. Then, on June 3, 1888, Thayer sent one last piece to the paper. It was Casey at the Bat. Casey might have passed unnoticed were it not for a rising young comedian and singer, William DeWolf Hopper, who was appearing at a Broadway theater in New York. At dinner one evening, sitting in a restaurant with a friend, Hopper moaned, "I have two baseball teams coming to the theater as guests of the management tonight. How on earth will I ever keep them awake?" His friend removed a dog-eared newspaper clipping from his wallet and handed it to the up-and-coming actor. It was Casey. Hopper memorized it on the spot and that night performed the poem before the audience of baseball players. The poem was such a success that Hopper made it a permanent part of his program. Hopper himself reckoned that he had performed the piece over 10,000 times, and by 1900, almost everyone in America had heard or read the poem. As realistic as the tale may seem, Thayer always maintained that he had made up the entire story because of his love for college baseball. The poem, said Thayer, has no basis in fact. What do we find so appealing about Casey? He is boastful, he swaggers, he has an air of confidence so outrageous that it leads to his downfall. But there is an heroic air to Casey, and every time we read the poem, we hope that perhaps this time, just this one time, Casey will hit the home run that will win the game. Now, would you like to have some fun? Stand up. Get ready to march. Here's your tempo. Here we go. Thank you.
This is Stephen Simon, the composer and conductor of Casey at the Bat. Have you ever thought that music could tell a story all by itself? Well, it can. Let me show you how. Here's a song called In a Cabin in a Wood, which you may already know. If you do, sing along with us. Now, if you listen to the words, they are very dramatic. The rabbit is running for his life, desperately looking for a place to hide. If he can't find one, he will be turned into rabbit stew. Fortunately, a little man standing by his window sees the rabbit being chased by the hunters. He answers the knock on his cabin door and saves the rabbit's life. Pretty dramatic stuff, if you ask me. But is there any drama in the music? Listen. If you said no, you were absolutely right. So, I decided to write a composition that would describe the story in music. I call it The Flight of the Rabbit. If you listen carefully, you first hear the tranquil forest scene. Listen to the flutes. They are the birds singing happily in the trees. Composers often use flutes to imitate birds. Do you hear the cuckoo played by an oboe? This peaceful scene is broken by the rabbit, who first sticks his nose out of the underbrush. Listen for the piccolo. The rabbit is sticking his nose out of the underbrush, seeing whether he can make his dash for freedom. Then the rabbit breaks into the open field, frantic with fear. The hunters are riding in hot pursuit. The hunters are shooting as they ride. A horn player is performing the traditional hunting call. The rabbit knocks on the door of the kindly little man, who lets him in. Then I use the tune Come Little Rabbit Come Inside to show you where we are in the story. The hunters ride past the house and disappear into the distance, which you can hear as the orchestra gets softer and softer. We know that the rabbit is safe, giving us our peaceful ending. Here is a complete story in music, without a narrator, and in less than 2 minutes. Thank you. let's return to Casey at the Bat. You have already heard the Casey March, played by a symphony orchestra and by a concert band. But it can even be played in the Suzuki style. Listen to this group of very young violin students, and then I'll be back to tell you how I composed Casey. I composed Casey at the Bat as a theater piece for orchestra and narrator. The musicians are asked to perform the roles of the umpire and the crowd, and vendors selling popcorn, hot dogs, soda and beer, and programs, as well as play the music. When the ball is hit, a percussionist strikes the woodblock with a wooden mallet, and when the batter is out, a disappointed "Oh!" comes from the Mudville fans. The whole piece is based on the Casey March. When things are going well for the team, the march sounds like this. But when things are going badly for the Mudville Nine, the theme slows down to take on a despondent feel, a sadness which reflects the impending doom. When Casey steps up to the plate, it takes on a jazzy style in the clarinet and bassoon, reflecting the bragging, swagger, and overconfidence of the great slugger. When he quiets the outraged fans by raising his hand, the theme takes on the character of a Salvation Army band, that fine organization which provides for the poor. Many of their members play brass instruments in ensembles on the streets, especially at Christmas time. In addition, there is the well-known trumpet call, which, at least in United States sporting events, urges one's favorite team on to victory. But when this urging brings poor results, listen to what happens to the fanfare. Now that you know a little more about the music, I invite you to listen to Casey at the Bat once again and see how much more of the story you can hear in the music.
The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2, with but one inning left to play.
Now batting, number 10, the left fielder, Cooney.
A good one, Cooney. A little finger, baby.
And so, when Cooney died at first...
Now batting, number 12, the first baseman, Barrows.
And Barrows did the same. A sickly silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought, if only Casey could but get a whack at that, we'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake, and the former was a pudding, and the latter was a fake. So upon that stricken multitude, grim melancholy sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let fly a single to the wonderment of all. And Blake, the much despised, tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and they saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe on second and Flynn a hugging third. Then from the gladdened multitude went up a joyous yell. It bounded from the mountain top and rattled in the dell. It struck upon the hillside and recoiled upon the flat. For Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when, responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat, no stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then, while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip. And now,